one of the great authors of this kind of thing went up to Corinth and measured dining room, old dining room, to figure out how many people you could have lying out against the wall, because the inside is where the servants came. So there. And if you go to St. Clement's in Rome by the Colosseum, you go to where the church is on the top, and then you go down to a Romanesque church, and you go down to the basement. That's the dining room of the Senator Clemens of Rome. That's why it's St. Clement. And as the people got a little bit more, people became followers of Jesus, they could really only go to wealthy people's homes who had a place where a lot of people could come. Interesting. John's Gospel is totally different on the Last Supper. It goes on and on and on and on. Because you've got all those speeches in it, you know? It's a lengthy section. However, there is one thing I would like to sort of stress, and this comes from Raymond Brown in his commentary on John's Gospel that comes out from Anchor Bible. And that is, if you don't understand the washing of the feet, you will not understand the death of Jesus. And that's really true now. You don't find that in Matthew, Mark, Luke. There's no washing of the feet. That the washing of the feet and the phrase that you do find in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, I have not come to be served, but to serve. And if you want to understand what the death of Jesus is, and that's going to be your next meeting, when you take the death of Jesus, then what he's saying is, meditate deeply on the washing of the feet. Serving other people. And when you think of your own mother and father, and you may have a nice picture of them when they were young, beautiful girl, handsome man, just getting married, you know. Then just before they died, wrinkles, gray hair, you know. And they worked hard so that we could go to school. They took years off of their life. They washed our feet. And in washing our feet, they disintegrated. Washing of the feet is the idea of service. And we die in many ways. Dying on the cross is simply one way. And dying on the cross, Jesus, this is why what I believe, this is what I stand for, and this is why you're putting me to death. And he loved them unto the end, kind of thing. So the Last Supper is different in all of these, a little bit different in all of these. And what they're sort of saying is, washing of the feet, keep your eye on Jesus. Focus on the Jesus person. Then you come to the Gethsemane. And Gethsemane means olive press. That's the word itself. It means the press. Okay. Again, Gethsemane is within this extra wall. It's not inside the walls. It's outside the walls of the city of Jerusalem. But for the Passover time, it's inside. So it's a place that it's referred to, and it was during that Passover time, that, you know, you could go to, because you're not supposed to leave the city of Jerusalem. Whereas Bethany, where Mary and Martha lived, was outside, so they didn't go to You think, why didn't they go over to Mary and Martha's place? But that was outside. So you have that kind of a situation here. Again, when you look at, and you just go through it and sort of compare notes of Mark, Matthew, Luke, and John. Mark, with the time in Gethsemane, is really not very, very, very long. Here. And then. The agony in the garden. And it really just says that Jesus went away to pray, came back and he found the men sleeping in front of the television. Couldn't you just watch 1 hour? He prayed again. So what is the focus with Gethsemane? Jesus sort of saying something evil is going to happen. And they're saying, at that time, keep your eye on Jesus. What did he do when something evil was beginning to bubble up in his life? He prayed. When you have problems, follow Jesus. Don't follow those disciples and go to bed. If you have time to pray, pray when things are going bad. Don't decide, I'm going to clean house, then I won't think about it. Bring prayer in. That's the model that Mark gives. Matthew makes it a little longer, of course. Matthew always did that. He would have a much larger kind of thing. Okay. But it's the same thing, really, almost the same as Matthew. But while he was speaking, Judas comes, this betrayer had arranged a sign, the one whom I shall kiss. And Judas comes over, hail Rabbi, and he kisses him. So he goes into a little further detail of the Jesus thing. And then Peter taking out his sword. Why he had a sword, nobody knows. Yes. And ladies and gentlemen, don't write your thesis on that subject. Why Peter have a sword? We don't know, and the best thing is we don't care. It just sounded good. But at the very end of it, Matthew says, then all the disciples left him and fled. Again, the focusing is this of Jesus at prayer. And if problems do arise, stay with Jesus. Don't flee. Very Jesus-centered. Now we go to Luke and the Gethsemane situation. Briefly sending signs at the end, annunciation. Okay. He goes out, they pray, the same thing, the betrayal, kiss, etc. And day after day, Jesus says, I was with you in the temple, and you didn't seize me, but this is your hour, the time for the power of darkness. Why do bad things happen to good people? Jesus doesn't give us an answer. But he just sort of saying, bad things will happen. Keep your eye on Jesus and God and pray. In John, this section, When he had said this, Jesus went out with his disciples. They went into the garden, and Judas came along, etc. And Jesus said, "Whom are you looking for?" And they answered, "Jesus the Nazareth." And he said to them, "I am." And they fall back. In the book that we were reading here, Borg and Dominic Crossan, it mentions a huge number of soldiers. I couldn't find how that was verified. Mm-hmm. You know, that probably it's one of these things where he says that the band of soldiers was there, and a tribune was there, and all of these names in John, and you could figure out there were 100, there were 500. That's way too many. Mm-hmm. Way too many. It's sort of an exaggeration. So, what it is. But you'll notice, again, John, in a very dramatic way, I'm looking out at all these soldiers. Who are you looking for? And they say, "Jesus of Nazareth, I am." And you all fall back. Mm-hmm. And you try it again, and you all fall back. And you try it again, and you all fall back. You know? In other words, the authors are saying, "Jesus, Jesus, Jesus, mm-hmm. Jesus." This is this Jesus of John's Gospel that really doesn't walk on the earth. He became flesh, yes. The Logos became flesh. But there were, you know, wooden souls between the earth. Because in John's Gospel, Jesus is always sort of an ethereal kind of individual. And here too, he has this power. But you see, but he doesn't use power in a way that's changing God's intention. What can we say about Gethsemane? Basically then, prayer. Even in times of need. And God is greater than any problem. Evil is not the final answer, because God is greater. And with that, we come to the last point about the trial. And in the research the sections that we have with the trial, throughout there, and the Jews said, "Kill him." And then later on, we get all of this anti-Semitism kind of thing within the church, Protestant and Catholic, within the church. But in the Gospel, you can hardly read anti-Semitism in it. And that Family Feud thing has got to be heard again. That the Pharisees, especially that Matthew was talking about, are these people from Jamnia that are coming up and creating a misreading of who these followers of Jesus are. This is another thing that I have a little problem with Borg and Crossan. They use the word Christian. And I don't think you can really use the word Christian until about 90. Mm-hmm. When the split between the Jewish people and the followers of Jesus. And just by using the word Christian in there, you know, you're sort of using a term of a religion, you know, and we haven't really become a religion. Mm-hmm. If you had said to any of these people, "Were you Jewish?" "Yes, I'm Jewish." And they went to the synagogue, they went to the temples. 90 to 100, the Johannine community, they were thrown out of the synagogue. You know? So they still felt Jewish religion. It's after 90 that the two groups move in different things, and now we can call them two religions. And that's when Christian takes on a good name. And if you use it before, then most people, like ourselves too, we think, "Oh yeah, they were already Christian." Was Peter a Catholic? he's a Roman Catholic? Did he even know he was the Pope? You have to have a wider view of this kind of thing. And from our own Franciscan background, you know, brother son. Is the son Catholic? No. Is the son Lutheran? No. Is the son Muslim? No. That's my brother. Mm-hmm. And you don't want to brother, son, sister, boom, and they're all baptized. That's not what it's about. We were really within one fold. And Jacob Neusner, who's one of the best of the Jewish scholars today, says at the time of Jesus, this is in his book on Jewish spirituality in that Pollock series, Jewish spirituality, he says, there were a lot of Jewish sects, S-E-C-T-S. There was also Jewish sects. Jewish sects. And so he uses the term Judaisms, a plural. Mm-hmm. One of them being the followers of Jesus. Mm-hmm. Judaisms. So I type that into my computer, and then when I have scrolled through to, you know, are these the correct languages? Am I any spelling mistake? Judaism's incorrect. Mm. Or it would take the S off automatically. Mm. But that idea that it was still one of the, a part of the Jewish world. Yes.
When did the word Catholic start to be used for the church? Initially, was it in its small C sense and then moved into an identifying word?
Yeah. It was used basically up through 300, 400, 500, 600, 700 in the small sense, meaning that we had been sent out to the whole world, Matthew's Gospel. In that sense, because it comes from two Greek words, kath, holon, and it is for everywhere. Mm-hmm. Kath, for, holon, everywhere. Show to go out like that. Mm-hmm. Does that help? And then, you know, even in the medieval period, you didn't really speak about the Catholic Church. What other church was there? Mm-hmm. You know, Christian church. So in the 1400s, when you begin to have Wycliffe and other groups, then Catholic becomes sort of the denomination idea of it.
In the Last Supper, when Jesus takes the blood or the wine and says, "This is my blood," how would good Jews have responded to those words? I didn't think that they drank blood from animals. How would they have responded to that?
In Chinese, we would say, "Wo bu zhi dao." I don't know. Now, you asked a very good question. Because, did they think of transubstantiation? No. Did they think of real presence? Jesus was there already. They didn't have to think of real presence. No. What did they think of? Certainly they thought of something symbolic. That this was, as it would have been in the Passover, and they were not, this wasn't a Passover meal, but this was a special meal. So at the beginning of every special meal, if they were really pious Jews, you would have the leader of the house take the bread. So think of one of these baguettes. You know, take the bread, break it, and ask for God's blessing. And at the end of the meal, everybody would have a little bit of wine, probably had water in it, you know. If they were poor, that made the wine last longer, you know. It's no big thing to put water into wine. By the mystery of this pouring of water into wine, we celebrate the mystery of the divine and the human. That's theological. Ha 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 it was a very practical thing for Jewish people who were poor to put a little wine in because they knew the grandma would take too much. They didn't have the money to pay, you know. So, what would they have thought about? They would have thought, this is a very special moment in which God is with us. And their focus would be, because of Jesus, God is with us. Today, in our own Catholic Church, Vatican II, the decree on liturgy, Paul VI, his encyclical on the Eucharist, the Catechism of the Catholic Church in its discussion, Jesus is present when two or three are gathered in my name. Jesus is present when you do works of mercy. Jesus is present in the reading of the Word. Jesus is present when you are helping someone through death or something like that. And Jesus is present in all the sacraments. And Jesus is present, but in a special way, in the Eucharist. Where'd that come from?
Yeah.
If Jesus is present, how do you say, but in a special way? Now, in my book on baptism, confirmation, and Eucharist, when I get to that, I quote Paul VI. And then I say, with all due respect to Paul VI, there is, because he says it, and in a much greater way and more important way, Jesus is present in the bread and the wine after the words. I said, there's more important. We call it the incarnation. God becoming man. Certainly John would have said that. And the Word became flesh. So, you know, they had no idea of anything like, quote, we would have today, the real presence of Jesus. The wine had become the blood of Jesus, kind of thing. More the symbolic thing. That as in the celebration by the Jewish people at Passover, when a family got together and celebrated Passover, reminding them of when they passed out of Egypt into the new land, passing over, God looked down and blessed that early group with Moses. God looking down remembers and blesses us. So when he sees this group taking the bread at the beginning, blessing us and passing it around, taking the wine at the end, blessing us, passing it around, they say, once again, God is blessing us with his presence. I think you can say that. Does that help?
Yes, thank you.
Let me get this one here and then back to you. Okay?
Ever since I read the John Shelby's Bond's book on the sins of Scripture, I've had a problem with Judas. But he spends a whole chapter talking about that Judas was made up later on, before 400, I think it was. It's been a long time since I've read the book. Kind of a combination scapegoat person. I wonder if in all of your, you know, studies and so on, that's ever come up.
Well, when you say, was Judas a scapegoat person?
Okay.
That's what she's asking. And Judas was a made-up person. Third or fourth century, you sort of thing.
Well, like I said, it's been a long time.
Okay, it's just made up. Let's put it that way.
But he had a lot of, you know.
It's in order to get somebody to get this thing going, whatever it might be. The problem is that Mark wrote his gospel, say, around 70, and that's when the first time you hear of a Judas individual. Written down. That would be a little early to think that that a fellow like Mark would make it up, and then it would be believed, you know, and accepted. and Matthew reading it would accept it too. So there must be some way or another that Judas, one of the 12, could easily have done something to make the arrest a little bit easier. But as you know, Jewish people are dramatic. You may have noticed that. when they get upset with their husband, oh my goodness, what have you done? You know, they get dramatic at this moment, kind of thing. It's in the Israeli blood, or Jewish blood to do that kind of thing. So it could have been that there would be somebody close to him that said, here's the time you want to go over. Because it's in all of them, it's there, and they aren't all that connected well together. But dramatically, the way it's done, that could have been just literary drama. With the cards coming in as well, and things like that.
Going back to Mary's question, for several years we went to our Jewish friend's Seder meal at Passover, and the cup of wine is drunk at four different times in that meal. And so I was just wondering, and it seems to me the Seder meal as it's practiced today has evolved, but what was the significance of the cup of wine at the time of the Passover meal that Jesus was drinking? What was the significance at that point that he connected himself to?
We know that around the time of Jesus and before, that generally speaking, there would have been a little prayer before meal and a little prayer after. And the before was connected at times with this breaking of the bread and passing it around, maybe on the Sabbath as well. And that the end was, this is the end, so we take our cups, we're going to finish it, and we'll bless God again. So it comes out of that. Now, as you say, these meals, you know, they do the same thing with a really fancy meal. You have a little something to drink before with an hors d'oeuvre, then they take that over, then they give you white wine, then they give you red wine, and they give you a little aperitif afterwards. You know, these things build up. But it's that, it comes out of that basis of before the eating, a good Jewish family, thank God for the meal, and at the end of it, thank God for health and family, kind of thing. So those became the two pivotal times. And in the ordinary meal, they didn't say prayers in between like that.
And so the whole Seder meal as it's come to be now, you know, it starts with why is this night different than any other night, and then it's really got a whole symbolism involved in it about remembering how God has brought them through. And very much like our Mass, the word I was thinking of when you were talking about memory is anamnesis, you know, a memory raised up. So yeah. An event in the present in the past is brought into the present and points to the future fulfillment.
And Jeremiah, in his book, on the Eucharist, he says on that question of anamnesis or remembrance, do this in remembrance of me. Who's supposed to do the remembering? Do we do the remembering? Or God looking down and seeing us doing something? Oh, I remember. And he says, God remembers that this is what the Jewish people did before they left. And now you're doing it again. I bless them, so I bless you. A little bit of a different way of looking at it. And this guy, Jeremias, his father was a biblical scholar, and he grew up in Palestine. He spoke Hebrew and Aramaic from the time he was 8 or 9, and just was an amazing scholar. Amazing.
Think that point you brought up about Judas being made up is a very interesting one, because why did they need a Judas? Everybody knew who he was. Jesus even says, I was teaching and preaching in the temple and you didn't arrest me. They all knew who he was. They didn't need somebody to identify him, and perhaps Judas was made up to blame the whole thing on the Jewish people by later Christians.
Well, it, you know, I'm not saying you're wrong.
I'm not saying I'm right. I'm just raising the question. Why did they have to have a Judas to betray him? Because all those soldiers and chief priests and scribes knew who he was. Didn't need somebody to point him out.
Well, if you look at the introduction here, when and where that question. Okay, Mark is around 70, Luke maybe 75, Matthew 75 as well, and John about 90. Four different places, areas, and there's a Judas story already going around. So that would have meant that it isn't these people that made it up, the writers. It had to be made up by somebody before that time. And it would have to have been a story, or it would be a story if they made it up, that wasn't just a story, let's say, in Matthew's community, a community of Caesarea Maritima, but also was in Rome, where Mark was, or in Syria, where Luke was, or over in Ephesus, where John was. And so you have to give a little bit of time for the story to get written, accepted, or it's not written, but it's accepted, and then all out, and it's all got to be done before, I would say, 60. Because if it arrived late, somebody would have said to Mark, Matthew, Luke, or those three at least, that only came last 10 years, why are you putting that in there? They would have been called on it in their writing of it, which we don't have. But if it was something that went beyond the memory of the local group, you know. Now, do you remember, you know, somebody might say to you, do you remember when you did X, Y, or Z? And you say, I don't remember that. And it might have been 30 years ago, but you may not remember it, but they do.
But some of the people at the time that Mark was written could have been alive when Jesus was going through.
I don't deny that, yeah. So, could it have been that way? I'm saying yes, but you'd have a lot of work to say Judas is a makeup.
By the time John was written, most of the people would not have been alive.
No, that's right. Okay, now we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 at the end.
Isn't human nature, though, to move ourselves away from our own way? So it could have been quite early, as we shrank, as people shrank from their own responsibility in the betrayal of Jesus.
Could have. Yeah. We don't have any data.
Well, in Marcus Ford's book, he says that it was temple soldiers that were sent by the chief priests and scribes who could possibly not even know who Jesus was. And that's why Judas had to identify who Jesus was.
Right, right.
And so it wasn't necessarily that everybody in the town knew it.
No, not everybody in Jerusalem knew who Jesus was. Temple guards, these would have had to be, because they're not going to get soldiers from Pilate at this first. These had to be soldiers under the leadership of the high priest. And, yeah, they, you know, they might not have known.
Yeah.
A lot of soldiers, you know, you could say you want to stay in jail or you want to be a soldier. And that's happened many, many times.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we'll either go in and be a soldier or we'll chop your head off. You know, you have, so these are probably not well-educated people or anything like that. And they're the soldiers that took care of them.
And they're just doing the duty.
Whatever. Yeah.
Wasn't it a point that used to be made, they didn't dare arrest Jesus in public because of the crowds. They needed somebody to show them where Jesus would be privately.
They didn't want to, you know, come into Times Square and arrest Jesus. No. They wanted to do it when the time nobody was around. Yeah. Okay, thank you. continue.
Okay. Changing topics. But I have always found it a bit anomalous. The church's insistence, the official insistence on this idea of transubstantiation. And yet, in the prayer, at the end of the presentation, we pray that this breath, that these gifts may become for us the body and blood of Christ. And it seems to me that prayer is saying that it is for us, that this is our perception of the bread and wine. And I find that argues with transubstantiation, at least for me.
Transubstantiation was first mentioned in 1100.
Oh, I know.
Okay. Then it got picked up and by Thomas Aquinas and the people of the 1200s. The Franciscans and the Dominicans have a very different view of what this means and how it's supposed to be. Then you get Martin Luther, who says it's consubstantiation, not transubstantiation. Then you get the Greek people. They have nothing to do with transubstantiation. It's a Western theological approach using Aristotelian philosophy to try to explain something that you can't explain.
Mm-hmm. I've heard the term used, transignification.
Transignification, yes.
I can live with that much, but more.
That's right. And, you know, when 1500 came and the Catholics and the Protestants divided, then we got very defensive of positions, and so did they. Consubstantiation, you know, bang, bang. And nothing. If you want to be a Catholic, you had to sort of go in that line. It's only been, say, since about 1940, actually, it's even earlier, because I read a book by Pizzarelli, the dogma of transubstantiation, and these new people coming in. This is 1922. So it's about 1922 when you have people saying, this doesn't work. Mm-hmm. Now, another just aspect of this. You have these molecules that make up the bread and wine. How many molecules are changed? And you laugh at it. This became a big discussion in two Italian journals in the 40s and the 50s. Somebody being very, very avant by saying, oh, there's a million transubstantiations that take place. And another person saying, the whole thing is stupid if you're going to go this way. It just really makes this kind of thing. If I were to go over to the University of California to the chemistry department and say, tell me what the nature of bread is, or the nature of wine is, they would say, well, bread is usually made up of a variety of molecular structures, and they would name about 10 or 11, 12, 15 of those kinds of things, you know? And wine is made up of these kinds of molecular structures. And they're just hooked together in an accidental way. That's bread, that's wine. So what is the nature of it? They don't speak in nature, you know. But they don't speak in nature. And these kind of things. So, transubstantiation, consubstantiation, that really does, if you're into Aristotle, it might work. But if you're out of Aristotle, it doesn't work. If you're into contemporary phenomenology, Heidegger, Maurice Merleau-Ponty, and people like that, Ricoeur, it doesn't work. And it's not a dogma of the church. It's a way that some theologians attempted to explain. And what we're trying to say is, this isn't just, you know, a little memento, but there is something very symbolically real about it.
Going back to the Judas discussion, I think the message of Judas is important because, and it was brought home to me in our class last week, because of the necessary tension there is between doubt and believing. and that we all have the capability to either be a traitor or to be the unnamed woman who gave her all. And I thought that, so I feel that, I think that the reports about Judas are significant, are really significant to believing versus not believing, or being capable of not believing and even being a traitor.
Well, I think you have some very good ideas, David. Because, you know, we all are a little bit Judas in our way of faith, whether it's Christian faith or Jewish faith or Muslim faith. We all have a little bit of that Jewish stuff that shows, the Judas stuff that shows up every now and then in our own activity. Sure. And we have to be honest and admit it. Yeah. So it does have an exemplarity thing that you don't want to lose. I have a feeling that somebody else.
A word came down.
And the word became flesh. This is called transubstantiation.
So thanks for the candidate.